Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, April 21st. Now that former police officer Derek Chauvin is officially the convicted murderer of George Floyd, some of the focus for systemic change will be on Washington with what's called the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2021. Reading from the bill's official page on the website of the House of Representatives, the bill, quote, includes measures to increase accountability for law enforcement misconduct, to enhance transparency and data collection, we'll talk about data collection, and to eliminate discriminatory policing practices. The bill, it says, facilitates federal enforcement of constitutional violations, for example, excessive use of force by state and local law enforcement. That's a key, federal enforcement of excessive use of force in local police departments. And among other things, the bill says it would do the following: lower the criminal intent standard from willful to knowing or reckless to convict a law enforcement officer for misconduct in a federal prosecution, authorize the Department of Justice to issue subpoenas in investigations of police departments for a pattern or practice of discrimination. That's very relevant with the breaking news just this hour that the U.S. Justice Department is going to investigate the Minneapolis Police Department beyond Derek Chauvin for patterns and practices of discrimination. And the bill also creates a national registry, the National Police Misconduct Registry, to compile data on complaints and records of police misconduct, and it establishes a framework to prohibit racial profiling at the federal, state, and local levels, as well as establishing new requirements for law enforcement officers and agencies. Here's the data part: to report data on use of force incidents, to obtain training on implicit bias and racial profiling, and to wear body cameras. Now, that's all from the language on the bill for the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2021. It is anything but a slam dunk that this will pass, but there's some of the language. We played some clips earlier of Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison from his remarks after the verdict. Here is one more Ellison clip addressing what he sees as the work of today's generations beyond the one verdict.
Finally, this verdict demands us to never give up the hope that we can make enduring change. Generations of people said slavery would never end. Generations said Jim Crow would never end. Generations said women would never be equal to men. Generations said if you were different in any way, you could never be a full and equal member of our society. Today, we have to end this travesty of recurring, enduring deaths at the hands of law enforcement.
With us now is journalist and commentator Jamil Smith, who's been on many times in recent years and just started a major new job this week as senior correspondent at Vox. Jamil, congrats on the new gig and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you having me on.
So, Jamil, part of the conversation we've been having since last night is how much to see this verdict as a turning point in police accountability and how much to be cynical about it as a kind of throwing one bad apple under the bus so they can say he was just one bad apple. Where would you say you are on that scale?
I'd say I'm probably somewhere in the middle, Brian. I think what's important to realize is that we did not really have a racial reckoning last summer after George Floyd's murder, as we can officially call it, and also Breonna Taylor's killing by Louisville police and Ahmaud Arbery's killing by local men in Georgia. We did not really have the racial reckoning that maybe we thought we had or we'd like to give ourselves credit for. What we did is, as Reverend Otis Moss put it in a comment to the New York Times, we have just simply addressed the symptoms. The disease is still there. And we're really not doing much to address the disease if we simply wait for Black people to die at the hands of police and then produce moments of empathy and moments of outrage and then don't see the kinds of systemic changes that prevent such happenings in the future.
I read some of the House of Representatives website summary of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act there. How much do you think real change in safety from unnecessary police violence runs through Washington versus local politics versus something more like a cultural change?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, communities are looking to Washington to provide a systematic and thorough and comprehensive solution to all of this. Now, the solution, I think, really doesn't have to start necessarily with reckoning. It has to start with deterrence. How do you get police to understand that they need to operate within certain parameters or else they won't be police anymore? How do you get them to operate more safely in communities so that, say, when they, you know, respond to a woman, a young woman calling the police, as Makia Bryant did yesterday in Columbus, and finds that she is, in fact, the one who shot four times by a police officer when she is attempting, ostensibly, to defend herself. Now, we have to, you know, understand that, you know, the rules like, you know, ending no-knock warrants and doing other things that are, you know, in this policing act would certainly, you know, prevent a lot of things, but it wouldn't prevent all of the, you know, the terrible things that that police can perpetrate. But that only means, I think, the police have to take it upon themselves, as long as police exist, to make the kinds of changes that have them seen in a better light. If they care about this, and in fact there are good apples on this rotten tree, then let's have them be involved in making the solutions. Instead, what we've seen time and time again, we've seen law enforcement officials and their unions fight against these kinds of systemic changes or pretend that they don't exist. And currently, in the sort of watered down Republican version of this bill, we see that perspective reflected.
Let's take a phone call from Lauren, who says she's former NYPD, now living in, is it Nashville, Indiana? Lauren, hi, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Bri. Say that Nashville, Indiana quietly, because I'm a stone New Yorker.
we'll send you a T-shirt.
Yes. The reason I'm calling is because I had a very interesting vantage point. Even though I was a professional actor and singer in New York for 25 years, when I wasn't doing that work, I did other things, and I had a propensity for criminal justice and also for counseling. And years and years ago, in between the New York years, I was a deputy. And when I'm listening to your show today, a couple of things are very stunning to me. When I was a deputy and we had roll call, and this was about 20 years ago.
Just to clarify that role, when you say deputy, what is that? Is that a police officer or what's a deputy?
A deputy for the sheriff's department.
Gotcha.
And so I did telecom and I also was on the road. And after roll call, many years ago, when you would be partnered up with somebody, people used to high-five and say to each other, let's go out there and keep the peace. And so many, many years later, 10 years ago, when I was also in New York and in between jobs, I was a counselor, and I worked also for counseling victims, families of homicide victims. I did suicide hotlines, but I also went to train to be an auxiliary officer, and I got placed in Midtown South. And after roll call, this time I was hearing everybody give high fives, and instead of let's keep the peace, I was hearing let's go kick some butt. And so in that 20 years, the attitude had changed so dramatically. And when I would go out with be partnered with the younger officers that were coming up in the police, I was stunned by their attitudes, their homophobic attitudes, their racism, and people not talking about video games, which was their original training as they were coming up. It was shoot to kill since they were 7 and 8 years old. And this young, you have to think about who is attracted to criminal justice. You start there. who wants to do this job, and where do they start to learn it, and what do they fantasize? What is the power they are dreaming of having? And it's such a important factor to consider, both the video games of shoot to kill, and blood doesn't really kill people, and it doesn't really hurt when we shoot a gun. And also, who is drawn to it? I had to quit after 2 years because I couldn't stand being in Times Square late at night with these young guys who hated me because my attitudes were old school, where I was there to help and to serve. Mm-hmm. It's changed dramatically.
Warren, I'm curious if from your perspective, and of course we can't verify that they used to say, let's go out there and keep the peace, and then they changed to let's go out there and kick some butt. But since it's been 10 years, if you've been in touch at all with that world since you stopped doing that work, and we've been talking about police reform, certainly for at least the last, 8 years after the stop and frisk era and in New York when de Blasio was elected on curtailing that and all of that. Do you have any reason to believe that it's changed back at all to more of a courtesy, professionalism, and respect, which is the official motto for the last 10 years or so of the NYPD?
Great question. First, I just want to tell you that those things of, the high fives, those were just the spirit of the guys after roll call. It wasn't a mandate or any part of the ritual, gotcha. Official ritual that they would say those things. I'm just giving you what the guys and the attitudes would be the differences. But in terms of your question, I can't speak to New York, staying in touch with New York guys, but I can speak to what's gone on here in this strange and awful state of Indiana, where it's gotten worse. They haven't become any more informed, or there's not more compassion. There's not more. It's actually worse. It's young guys looking for power and harboring the terror. It's Trump people here. And so that says it all. No, I have.
Lauren, I'm gonna leave it there. Thank you so much for your call. And
you bet.
Good luck out there, whatever you do. Of course, I will say it's very easy for New Yorkers to feel very superior to places in the Midwest. But
indeed it is. Considering that I come from Ohio.
Yes, you're a Cleveland boy, aren't you?
Indeed. And I live in Nashville, Tennessee currently. So I think it is useful for us to, take a little bit broader perspective when it comes to, how other people are living throughout the country.
But that aside, what were you thinking listening to Lauren? And there is, to the very last point that she made about what happens during Trump time or their Trump supporters, there does seem to be this, part of the political culture wars in this country seem to be that you have more law enforcement, more military lining up on the Trump side of things, and that Republican side of things is increasingly radical. So to the extent that really all lines up in any numbers, it's disturbing.
Well, I think it goes back to something you were talking about with Jamie earlier, and the police, the history of police in this country has been as essentially an appendage of white supremacy. I mean, that's really, we have to think about these things in a historical context. And we also have to think about what police have the power to do, which is to imprison, to jail. And that's something, certainly within the 13th Amendment, the loophole still exists, where, slavery is banned except this punishment for a crime. I believe it says whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, if I'm remembering correctly. And that gives the loophole, says, well, basically, if you are imprisoned, you're a slave again. This is the legal system that we seem to be okay enough with that we're not pressing for it to be changed. We are upset. We are horrified by the videotapes of people like George Floyd being murdered. But we're not moved enough as a society yet to you know, have this be a real catalyst for change. And we've been depending upon Black Death for decades now to push us further towards being the country that, you know, that Dr. King said, you know, should be true to what they said on paper. But, you know, how many of us need to die in order for people to try to realize, you know, what this country could and should be? That to me is the question that should come out of this trial, not, you know, what kind of reforms can be pushed now. I mean, yes, I mean, it's opportunism on behalf of politicians. And if they can use this to make change that's going to be effective and lasting, go for it. But this should be the end of that. We should be doing these kinds of changes even when there aren't any Dante Wrights or Makia Bryants and George Floyds and Philando Castiles and Tamir Rices. We need to be taking the, you know, the initiative to make these changes in our society, because I'm frankly, I don't understand how we live like this. I really don't.
You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the segment, the data aspects of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that's now before Congress, collecting data about police misconduct and about any use of force. And I'm curious, when you think about these turning point moments and how systemic the whole thing is, and, you know, people are disconnected from all the other incidents, except maybe the one that happened near them, except people in the movement. How much do you think seeing those numbers, whatever they are, might help clarify something that could lead to the right kind of change? Because I think about the gun debate in this country, right, where conservatives in Congress have long put up a barrier to even collecting data about shootings in this country. And maybe the same has been true about police use of force.
Yes. And, you know, just the same thing, you know, as I was saying before, we need to ask, why are they so opposed to us collecting data? What do they not want us to know? What do they not want us to see? See, I think that this case was particularly interesting because at the end of the day, the defense had no answer for what was on that tape. And in this regard, will they have an answer for data when that data is collected? It depends upon, I guess, how many of them that there are. If there are enough of them in the Senate to block a new legislation, perhaps, you know, it won't matter. If there are enough of them in state houses across the country, perhaps it won't matter. But that's where we as the voters need to get involved, and we need to be looking for people who, you know, are interested in actually finding out what the reality of America is about and finding out what needs to be fixed, as opposed to, you know, painting shellac over it and pretending that everything's okay.
On what needs to get fixed, last question. I could take calls from people all day who say, or you'll see it a lot in conservative opinion media, one of the threads is to ask why there is so much focus proportionately on this case and on police violence generally, bad as the Derek Chauvin murder of George Floyd was, and bad as some of these other cases are, but to them appears to the exclusion or at least disproportionate downplaying of the many more people who are dying in civilian murders than in police killings. I'm sure you've been asked that question.
It's the black on black crime question.
Right.
I think it's a red herring. I mean, I would ask those people to go to communities where there is a lot of this urban violence and, you know, see the protests that people have demanding that their communities be safer, demanding that their communities be insulated from this violence, and demanding, frankly, that police do better in trying to protect them. These people don't all necessarily want to abolish the police. I mean, defunding the police actually might help, because if you're putting the funding, you know, instead of trying to hire more officers who don't know how to handle mental health crises or know how to deal with, you know, people who are without homes, if you take that money and you allocate it to people who actually know what they're doing, it actually frees the cops up to do their, you know, their ostensible job, which is to protect and serve. And if we are going to have police in this country, we need to have police who understand that they cannot do everything and they should not be entrusted to do everything. We should be very specific about what we put empower them to do. And I think it's very important that they understand that this actually probably benefits them as much or if not more than anyone. These prospects for reform, because it enables them to possibly, be a lot more assured that they are going to go home much more safely at night. And for right now, for a lot of us in America, we can't even take the wheel and just drive to the grocery store without wondering if we're going to be coming home safely. So I ask those people to generate just even the most tiny smidgen of empathy for those of us who every single day worry about whether or not a police officer is going to end our lives.
Jamil Smith, now as of this week, senior correspondent at Vox. Vox is one of our great news organizations, in my opinion. Now it's going to be even better that you're there. Good luck over there, and keep coming on with us, Jamil.
I thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate that.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.